Dear Ms. Levant, thank you for reading this email right away, as you said you would in our contact of November 7th. Forgive its length, but there is much you need to know right now. Please respond immediately upon reading this. The future of the building you oversee and the safety of every one of its inhabitants, as well as your own, may be at stake. As I explained before, my name is John Hanley Elgin, and I am currently the organizational head of a paranormal research group that has worked quietly out of the University of California for the past 40 years. Yes, we investigate hauntings. I won't explain our history or our research methods here. There's a private link at the bottom of this email taking you to an unlisted site you can explore when you have time. But time has grown very short. 11 years ago, one of our data analysts detected an odd pattern in hauntings reported to our group since 1991. Several people residing in the Northeast who couldn't possibly know each other had similar visions in their homes of ghosts dressed in early Americana clothing, sometimes appearing as corpses, and also, if their properties were on the water, glimpses of a phantom ship in distress. Some suffered terrible nightmares, a persistent sense of being watched, or even startling behavioral impulses preceded by a torrent of unknowable symbols and letters streaming across their field of vision, whether their eyes were open or closed. These formed the lyrics to a kind of discordant, rasping song by some inhuman chorus assaulting the mind. Little by little, more patterns emerged. We came to realize that the houses where these phenomena occurred seemed to have subtle design similarities. We traveled to the country for many years, studying their structure and materials, and realized that each had a clear anomaly. Unusually old wood, stone, or glass embedded in unusual parts of the house, having no functional business there. Sometimes it was nothing more than a piece of scroll work in an unnoticed corner of a room, or random bricks in a fireplace. These oddities had been a selling point for the purchasers, and had been advertised long ago as a way to connect to the past. The outlier materials were eventually authenticated as being more than 250 years old. Parts were methodically extracted as much as each homeowner would allow, and eventually it was found that all these bits of ruins likely matched somehow, possibly part of a single original structure dating back centuries. Some bore virtually invisible traces of human blood, so old that only a procedure called crossover immunoelectrophoresis could detect them. There seemed to be a chance of some connection between these old building materials and the mystery of a lost early American colony called Hollanday, whose fate has never been adequately explained. Something on a par with the vanishing of the settlers of Roanoke. With the assistance of the British Museum, we turned to 10 pages of a diary by a literate settler who had lived in Hollanday, which was located in a wild region that eventually became eastern Rhode Island. Her secret pages were strange and terrible and deeply sad to read, and they began to form the key to everything.
1640, 23rd August. Father Roddy has told me that the sum of us that survived the wreck of August 6 is 65. 84 of us lost then. 30 in the storm, the rest by sickness. The ones who have made it inland are like me, starved, afflicted with weakness. Our wretchedness is past words. And now preparing for winter must be done so fast. The woods are so dense that in many places there is no cutting through. I hope tonight will be the first night since the wreck that I will not dream of it.
Out of the woods one day came an emaciated man calling himself Griffin Wilding, whose reasons for leaving a colony in Virginia and making his way so far north alone seemed strange and contradictory. But his knowledge of what it took to survive their first weeks in this cruel land was a big help to the settlers. He encouraged them to forego building a tiny chapel and instead pushed them to construct a bigger structure for their worship, one that could conceivably house all 65 settlers in case of more cruel storms.
1640, 28th September. Mr. Wilding calls himself a man of science, and he has odd instruments he says can predict the weather and other things of nature. But sometimes he blames the hard winds on forces that are not natural. No one is sure what to make of him. But we listen because we are desperate and he has education. The thought of another storm like the one that nearly destroyed us all is horrible. 1640, 4th October. The new building is at the end of the village, closest to the hill. It must serve as our chapel and also as the meeting place for all things. But the result of the men's work is forlorn. Mayhap most knowledge of architecture perished on the ship when Mr. Culver and Mr. McCallum were torn away by the sea. The structure looks slouched and not firm. There is only a single window. Mr. Corbett's attempts at painting the Christ child and the Last Supper were crude. The faces he drew are pallid and secretive-looking. He feels very badly about his lack of skill, but no one else came forward to try. This forenoon, Father Roddy told me something so out of the ordinary, I think he was sodded yet again. He said he felt strange feelings of dismay when consecrating the church, as if he had erred somehow in doing so. Like many others, he does not fully trust Mr. Wilding.
There came a gray and terribly windy day when Wilding's worst weather prophecy seemed to be coming true. The settlers believed Wilding when he told them the safest thing to do in the face of what felt to him like a disastrous oncoming rainstorm was indeed to congregate inside the enormous chapel.
1640, 18th October. The rain is fierce. Father Roddy came and assured me he will make a special service, and we will all sing All People That on Earth Do Dwell, all 65 of us, under the chapel roof together. Mr. Wilding is moving around from home to home outside to make sure no one is left behind. He knocked only a few minutes ago. He has been hurrying to make gallons of a special soup he learned from the Iroquois hundreds of miles to the south, in case we must sleep on the floor overnight. I feel such fear of the storm above us, but also, I must say, of Mr. Wilding. Even standing in the doorway, he frightens me so. But we have no choice but to let him guide us. No better plan is apparent. None at all.
The unnamed author's diary pages ended with a statement that she intended to secure them temporarily inside the chapel within a copper chalice, packed down into it with birch bark. Her hope was that the chapel was sturdy enough to survive even if her home were washed away. All 65 settlers were gone when a rescue party that came through the area months later found every structure in Hollanday burned to the ground. Their tiny homes, the woodshop, the beginnings of what appeared to be a schoolhouse. They noted the very curious absence of a chapel, however. Space had been cleared for the construction of something large, but where a foundation had once been laid, there was nothing. Nothing at all. For centuries, the mystery of Hollanday festered, but now we think we know what truly happened when that storm came through. Please bear with my extensive details. I find myself going slowly so as to make you believe what I have to tell you. I'm afraid if I rush, the tale will seem even more implausible. We found a second diary 18 months ago, you see, embedded inside a carefully carved hollow within a wood beam in a house built in 1938 in Darien, Connecticut. This diary was in extraordinary condition. Its author had encased it very effectively. It had been left as a confession and an apology.
When the people began to convulse in the middle of the night, I found myself attempting to play act, running from soul to offer empty aid. It was dreadful to see. I can only assume the soup was toothful, and their hunger great, because almost no one had gone without, Almost no one was spared the effects of the poison. Some ran out into the rain to die. Some made it into the woods, even. Only three who had apparently not indulged in the meal had to die by bullet after a short pursuit. Some, I suspect, saw quite clearly that this was my crime. John Noakes ran at me with a piece of sharp wood even as he coughed up blood. The entire ordeal consumed but 2 hours. The storm ended, and all became terribly quiet as the last of them died. I waited inside the chapel, and finally, just before dawn, Vicarach's voice came from the dark. It sounds to me like the grinding of rotted stone gears caked with tar. He told me he was pleased, that my work had made the Christian chapel unclean for all time, and his follower brights could now find content residence and slumber within its boards and stones. But there was much more work to do, work so terrible that for a moment I did not think I could bear it, though it is surprising what a man can cause to happen if the promised reward is great enough. 20th October. I am weary to my bones. I had to work quickly for fear the Narragansetts would come through the woods and locate the settlement. What toll it took upon my poor mind merely to imagine how I would carry out the second part of the task Vicarach had set for me. I sang Come Blessed Bird and All Creatures Now Are Merry-Minded over and over and over again as I worked. By nightfall I had hacked so many bodies apart my right arm was numb. I first had to drag all of them outside into the open air, lest the putrescence all around me cause me to fall gravely ill. The fires must absolutely cover all traces of the bodies and what comes out of them before I seek out the Narragansetts. They cannot even suspect. I wonder if the odor of that much burning flesh might somehow reach them across the woods. The blood of the settlers does indeed adhere onto the wood and brick well, and the cold rapidly darkens it into a color I cannot name. At first it is sticky to the touch, but then it dries much like paint. There was so much of it, it filled every bucket and bowl I could find. At some point I reached a state of such delirium and exhaustion that I collapsed, and finally heard Vicarach hissing at me through the dark that it was enough, that my next effort could begin.
In 1924, a commercial home builder digging deep into waterlogged swampland near Hamilton, Rhode Island, uncovered a large cache of wood, brick, and glass that had been interred perhaps hundreds of years before. As the legal owner of the vast plot, the builder, Ellis Rothschild, was entitled to do what he wished with the materials, though local historians alerted to the find appealed to him to donate them for study. But Rothschild saw only profit in its possibilities. He sold the materials in whole to a cousin in Belconson, Maryland, for an exorbitant sum. That man, named Jubal Gant, realized he could boost the marketing allure of his homes for the wealthy and educated by working loose parts into their structure. He preserved the cash carefully in a storage facility near Baltimore, and arranged for his architects to go about the business of looting the chapel's wholly unknown past, spreading its components all around the Northeast over the course of 3 decades of construction.
23rd October. Vicarach appeared to me only as a piece of long, slithering black ribbon, wending like a snake between the benches within the chapel. I was told where the Narragansetts must bury the chapel's remains, and why. The ground must be wet deep within, or it will all rot. That awful voice explained to me how the lack of air aids preservation. 4 miles north lies the spot. I must make it happen before the ground freezes. I will set out to find Seed Planter again at sunrise, and with luck, he will still act favorably towards me. 31st October. Somehow it is arranged. I convinced Seed Planter that the settlement was decimated by a great storm, and all had caravaned to the sea to wait for rescue from this terrible land. The fires had been set at first to keep the homeless among us warm, and to the rest of the structures burned simply because nothing could be taken with us. I explained to Seed Planter, who was plainly doubtful, that in our beliefs we could not possibly destroy a consecrated chapel. We must preserve it at great sacrifice, and so we would dismantle it and bury it instead, allowing some future generation to disinter and rebuild it. I offered him everything that was left behind, all the beads, pots, rifles, fabrics, and the like, all I was able to collect. He regards me with the greatest mistrust. I watched him and 2 dozen of his tribe begin to break the chapel down and carry it all away into the woods at dawn. An awesome physical feat.
I wish I could accurately describe, Ms. Levant, some of the horrors certain homeowners in possession of some of the chapel's materials reported to our group over the past 35 years. No less than 12 had an adverse experience inside their homes, which made those of us working to uncover the facts ever more nervous about keeping the materials near. Finally, after one of our graduate assistants suffered an inexplicable, violent fit, threatening to throw a child off the roof of a library building on the Irvine campus, we physically segregated all those bricks and boards far away from us.
5th November. One of the Narragansetts, having suffered some sudden miasma in the night, Seed Planter threatened not to persist in this labor. He dragged me awake and showed me how the man's eyes had rolled back in his head so far it had blinded him. Seeming accursed, he gibbered and hammered on the planks that had served as pews inside the chapel. An hour later, he had at least partially recovered enough to withdraw into the forest, vowing not to return. I implored Seed Planter to understand how demanding was our God. These materials must be interred. 11th November. Tomorrow their toils will be complete. Seed Planter will no longer even touch my hand. I had concealed the blood-painted boards as best I could for their carriage overland, but I believe the Narragansetts must know something went terribly wrong in the settlement that defies explanation and belief. It is likely before setting out to this infernal swampland, Seed Planter sent a party east to the sea to confirm my story. He is a moral man. Yet they will finish what they began. And I understand now that fear, more so than generous payment, has kept the Narragansetts working. They fear what I traffic with, but which they can't see, hear, or prove. Yes. The chapel lies in its diminished and broken state, deep below the earth. Tomorrow I will be free to move ever north. Last night my eyes opened as I lay on the cold ground, and for a moment I believed I glimpsed something terrible in the feeble reaches of the firelight. Some shadowy thing, not human and not beast, but made only of disjointed patches of smoke and darkness. The motions of its form suggested it was cavorting, capering with pleasure. It whispered to me in Vicarok's ghastly voice that I was a good servant, and would survive the winter no matter what afflictions it brought, and that if I continue in his service, a life extended centuries beyond the borders of a normal human span is assured me. I wept silently. I appealed to my dear mother's spirit to make me stronger against my tortured nature. I intend to bury these pages with the chapel itself, though what if the demon sees? Does he not see all? Will he even care? I will attempt it regardless. Perhaps those reading my words 100 years hence will come to an empathy I cannot summon for myself.
There is not that much more I can tell you in this letter. Another link below will explain to you the etymology of what Wilding's diary referred to as follower bright. Cruel spirits that seek preservation in corrupted physical objects, like bears entering hibernation against long winters. For a follower bright, these metaphorical winters can last thousands of years. But their slumber is anything but restful. They never stop dreaming of serving their protector demons through acts of chaos and violence. Even when they cannot directly do so, they infect their surroundings and the people in them. It can be extremely dangerous to approach or live near their tiny habitats of stray pieces of corrupted wood, stone, iron, and glass. What we are slowly coming to believe is that they stir even more restlessly, become more able to act out beyond their confinement. In times of great meteorological upset, such as hurricanes, blizzards. In 1957, the architect of the mansion you now spend so many of your days in contracted to include a dozen pieces of the Hollandaise Chapel as part of the structure. The mansion's original owner hung himself in 1962. His son lived in it for years before doing the same in 1971. It fell into steep decline after that, unowned for decades. 2003 was the year, you may know, that the state purchased it and very slowly renovated it, first into the offices of the Chancellor County Historical Trust, and finally into what it has become today, Iona Beach Methodist Children's Hospital. It could be, Ms. Levant, that neither yourself nor anyone who has ever worked in your building has suffered the adverse effects of what I now believe hides within the decorative posts that greet visitors to your garden outside the west wall, and within the railings that line two of the hospital's staircases. But I honestly do not believe no one has ever felt anything wrong there. Some sense of being watched, perhaps. Visions of ghostly things. The sudden desire to harm. Bursts of arcane symbology inside their eyelids, sung by a barbarian chorale. I counted 30 patient rooms when I walked through last week, and I understand there are rarely vacancies for long. If you believe I am not in my right mind, then so be it. I am ready to present every bit of the group's data and turn you over to voices more authoritative than mine. But for now, what might be Iona Beach's largest storm in 10 years is said to be brewing in the Atlantic, due for landfall next Monday. I am not sure exactly what course of action I would recommend in this moment, other than to watch and listen and beware. And if you have sensed something in the air inside the mansion, please tell me the story. Sincerely, John Henley Elgin.
Franco, you may have been copied on an email from jhelgin@ucal.edu. That's so crazy long with so many images, it keeps crashing my Outlook before it even loads. I apologize. You can just delete it without reading it. I'm not going to either. It's from a very strange man. I tried to humor, but I've now blocked entirely. Been feeling real off today, so headed to the doctor. Back Monday unless you hear from me. Thanks. FL.
July 7th, 2035. We're getting flooded by survivors of the earthquake. In the chaos, this strange man, Griffin Wilding, just left without anyone noticing. There is zero chance of him finding a bed in some other shelter right now, and I hate to think of him wandering L.A. spouting his bizarre stories to people struggling right now to make it from 1 hour to the next. He was kind of an interesting case to me, but I think he's probably headed for a lonely end.